We're going to be talking some about evolution in this part of Focus 580, and it is the case, I think, that most people, when they think about evolution, they think about a process that is very slow and takes a very long time, something on the order of millions of years. This morning, our guest, Stephen Palumbi, he's a biologist, says, in fact, that the pace of evolution has been picking up and that humans have been directly involved in that, and that now, indeed, we see evolution in many cases occurring very, very quickly. He writes about this in his book, The Evolution Explosion, How Humans Cause Rapid Evolutionary Change. That's the subtitle. It's published by W.W. Norton. Stephen Palumbi is professor of biology at Harvard University, where he teaches evolution, marine biology, and molecular ecology, and also does research on populations and molecular genetics of marine animals. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. All we ask of callers is that you try to keep your comments brief. And we ask that so we can keep things moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone is a welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Professor Palumbi, hello.
Hello there, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
We appreciate it. As I mentioned, I think that, and you certainly point out in the book, that people do have this idea that evolution is this thing that, you know, it's it grinds exceeding fine, but it takes a long time. And that it's something, in fact, Darwin believed, I think at one point in you argue that he may have been right about a lot of things, but this may be one thing that he got wrong. That he thought it had to take a long time. And in fact, you say that there are plenty of examples all around us for rapid evolution.
That's right. And in fact, we know evolution can take a long time, and Darwin really focused on that. But even he knew that evolution could be really rapid. He knew, for example, that domesticated plants and animals evolved very quickly under the crush of human intervention. And he called that artificial selection, very different than natural selection. But the main difference was one of speed and the fact that humans were the ultimate cause of the evolutionary change in domesticated animals. And if we just take that as a starting point, what we can see is that happens all around us now, not just in cases where we want to affect change, but in a lot of situations in which our normal activities, that are normal for us anyway, generate this accidental evolutionary change. And the fact that evolution can be fast, really fast, with it happening within our lifetimes, happening even over a course of a single year, means that humans are really affecting the evolution of species around us in ways that matter to our daily lives.
Hmm. Well, it also seems to be the case that even the pace of this kind of rapid evolution with human agency is picking up because for example, something like domestication of animals did take a little time, but now we can point to cases where, for example, bacteria would develop antibiotic resistance, and that something like that might happen as quickly as a year.
Well, that's right, and we have seen that over the last couple of decades. The antibiotic era just really started in the middle of World War II with the commercialization of penicillin, but within a few years we were making penicillin on an industrial scale, and it didn't take very long before bacteria started evolving resistance to it. So right now, for example, that has gone to such an extent that penicillin is useful for some things, but a lot of major hospital infections are mostly resistant to penicillin. We've invented other drugs to sort of take their place, and so what we've gotten into is an arms race with bacteria. The arms race is driven along by evolution, and the point of the book is to simply show that evolution as a biological process is something we really understand well enough to be able to come to grips with this arms race, see it for what it really is, and then know what to do about it.
Mm. Well, I think also you point out the fact that it's something that we should be aware of and that perhaps we have not taken note of to the extent that we should.
Right.
And that when you look at some of the examples, you know, for example, the classic story about the finches and their bills that Darwin wrote about, and mm-hmm. how it is over time this can change in response to environmental conditions. And one might think, oh, that's a nice and it's a benign process and it takes some time, and that's, you know, that we're talking about bird beaks after all. What's that got to do with us? But I think you're trying to point out to the people, and you write about it in this way, that the real story of evolution has teeth and that there are real consequences that in fact have been cataloged, and yet their day-to-day impact hasn't really been noted, and that the fact that you would argue that this is evolution has actually even been ignored.
Well, it has, and the trouble is that not only do we tend to think of evolution as being slow, but we also tend to think of it as being not that important to what we really do. I mean, what's really important to what we do is technology and the changes that brings to us, and health and medicine and the environment. Those things really impact us, and so we're worried about them. But evolution is an idea, and so we don't tend to think of it as being something that will really strike us at home. But when you begin to look at the examples that you can find, you realize that in fact evolution does impact a lot of our daily lives. One of the examples that I try to bring to home in the book is what happens when you take your child, your 1 or 2 year old, to the doctor because they have an ear infection. They may be in a lot of pain and crying, and of course you're all upset because it's your kid, and the physician might tell you it's a virus, it's a viral infection, it'll get better, and they won't give you any antibiotics. So, you know, any of us who have been parents know that you want that pink juice, you know, the amoxicillin, because that's going to make your kid feel better and it'll stop them from hurting and you'll be able to sleep tonight. And yet, more and more and more pediatricians are saying, no, I'm not going to give you the amoxicillin because it's viral, and the antibiotic isn't going to cure this disease. So, you're a parent, what do you say? You don't say, okay, you say, well, I want it anyway. Suppose it isn't viral, suppose it's bacterial, then just give this to me in case it's not viral. And the reason why that's not a good idea is that using antibiotics more than you should causes the evolution of resistance. It causes the development of resistant bacteria in your own kids, so that when you really need those antibiotics, they're not going to be useful because you've used them too much in the past. So that's the kind of example I think that a lot of people really, really know about. They've experienced it. It's been a problem for them, but they don't think of it as evolution, but it really is.
Well, let me just take that one step further, because I think it does go to what people think of when they hear the term evolution. And they might say, well, if for example, E. coli develops resistance to a particular antibiotic, that what we're still it's still E. coli.
Right.
And that they have this idea that, well, what we're talking about when we talk about evolution is dinosaurs becoming birds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fundamentally different thing with E. coli. So it changes in a little bit, but it's still E. coli. It's not like it's becoming something different.
Right.
And they would perhaps question applying the term evolution to this kind of adaptation that we're seeing in this particular organism.
Yeah, but it's not really a problem applying that term. First, the term evolution just means the change of something. And we understand the biology of that pretty well by understanding how natural selection works on things and how that leads to those organisms evolving over time. And this book is really not about dinosaurs turning into birds. This book is really about the changes that we affect around us. Those are evolutionary changes because they happen because of the rules of evolution that we know about, and that's what I'm really concentrating on. Now, does it mean that it helps us understand these other processes? I think so, because most biologists and most people that understand the ideas about how dinosaurs evolved into what are now birds realize that the same biological process was going on there, but it played out over a longer period of time. This book really just focuses on the short period of time, because that's the period of time we're living in right now. And we can see examples of evolution happening all around us. If we ignore those examples, then what we do is we create bigger and bigger problems that cost us more money, and they cost people's lives. So you can sort of turn it around, actually, and say that because people are unsure about dinosaurs turning into birds, which they should not be, but they are. But because they're unsure about that, they don't want to teach evolution in schools. That means that students don't learn about the basic biological process, and then they're ill-equipped to deal with these problems, like the evolution of antibiotics, the evolution of AIDS, the evolution of weeds in a farmer's field, for example, is an evolutionary process that we need to allow people to understand.
Just real quick, and I have a caller here, and then we'll get to this caller in just a second, but to just so that people understand what it is that we're talking about, the process where we're talking about, just to review, what we're talking about is something that works because when you look at any population of individuals, within right. that population, there will be some naturally occurring variation, that is, one will be a little bit different from the other. And right. if some of those variations due to a change in the environment become give that individual an advantage, and if that variation is something that can be passed on genetically to succeeding generations, then if the environmental change continues long enough, then what we'll see is a change in the individuals to accentuate that characteristic.
That's right. And so we can see that happening over the short period of time and see how populations change from generation to generation. The example of Darwin's finches in the Galapagos are a good example of that because it's a natural; those are natural populations responding to how the environment changes. They change a little bit from year to year. The accumulation of those little changes, if they were to happen all in the same direction for a long time, would be big enough to suggest to us that they were different species. So we can see how to connect the small changes to the larger changes. It's harder to see that in our own lifetimes because those accumulations take longer. So this book really focuses on the things we can see right in front of us and why they make a difference to us.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Stephen Palumbi. He's professor of biology at Harvard University. His book is The Evolution Explosion, How Humans Cause Rapid Evolutionary Change. It's published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana for a caller. Line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I just want to expand on some of the questions that David just asked. I think in late years, the definition of evolution has changed. We do have a distinction, I guess, between what we call microevolution and macroevolution, where microevolution requires no change in genetic material at all, but simply the manipulation of existing genetic material. In classic terms, that's not evolution. That's selective breeding. We've been doing that forever, and it is true, as you said early in the broadcast. Now, Darwin understood that, or he knew that farmers could manipulate their breeding stock, and that's been going on forever, and it isn't evolution. It relies totally on existing genetic material, and it adds no new genetic material. As you attempt to make the selective breeding changes greater and greater and greater, you arrive at the species barrier. You do not cross a species barrier. As a matter of fact, as we try to breed species such as dogs, and we get further and further from the general into specific characteristics of dogs, you get problems with distemper and deformation. So the species barrier is still there, and it's firm. Now it is true that in insecticides and certain things like that there is a kind of a selective breeding that goes on, but that is still quite well within genetic variation. In other words, given a whole bunch of insects, you spray a field, and there are a few of those insects that are just naturally resistant or immune to the insecticide that you're using, and those immune insects will proliferate. They don't evolve. That is, they're existing within they're operating within the existing genetic variation. I think that where you have populations of viruses, where there are virtually quadrillions of viruses, And all they have to do to defeat an antibody is change the shape of their coat. That is to say that there's a molecular coat that is coating the outside of that virus. A genetic accident could happen that changes the shape of that coat. Now, that could be what you really call evolution, and it could defeat an antibiotic.
I think you made the same point, raising the question, what is or is not evolution, and is this it? Yeah, well, let's let, yeah, Professor Palumbi, go ahead and respond to the caller.
It's an interesting distinction, and we can run with it and see where it takes us. The caller is trying to make the distinction between changes that happen because of the sorting or the shuffling of naturally occurring variation and changes that happen because new variants arise by mutation in the population. So evolutionary biologists would call both of those evolution.
Yeah, that's right.
But even if we didn't, let's just focus on the role of mutation. That's what the caller is really talking about, that mutation is not playing a role in the process, and so it doesn't count as evolution. In fact, mutation does play a role, and we know so much about how some of these new traits evolve that we can identify the mutations that happened, say, in a pest population that gave rise to these new abilities. For example, mosquitoes. I'll just take one of the examples that the caller brought up. Mosquitoes used to be very susceptible to organophosphate insecticides. But in the mid-1970s, somewhere in the world, probably in southern France, so it's not quite too clear, a mutation happened that allowed a mosquito to take the organophosphate insecticide and keep it from affecting the nerves of the insect. The mutation was essentially a exaggeration of the number of genes in that insect for a particular protein. That new mutation was so good at resisting organophosphate insecticides that mutation became very common in that population, and that population has since spread all over the world. Now, that's something that did not occur before the mid-1970s. It occurred in a population by mutation, and the populations of mosquitoes have evolved since then. Another good example is, in fact, penicillin resistance. That penicillin is broken down by bacteria because they have an enzyme now that takes the penicillin and breaks it apart. That enzyme didn't used to work on penicillin. It used to work on something else, but a mutation happened in it that allowed those bacteria that had the mutation to thrive in the presence of penicillin. So in those cases, and there's many others we could talk about, it isn't just the shuffling of pre-existing genetic variation that we see changing in the world. We really are picking up new variants. It's not just viruses, although I could give lots of examples of viruses. The caller is really right. That happens very quickly, especially in HIV. But we've seen those new mutations occur in bacteria, in viruses, in insects, in weeds, and they all fuel evolution. So one way to look at it is not that there's a distinction between evolution that happens because of shuffling of variation and evolution that happens because of mutation, but mutation generates the variation in a population. That's the fuel of evolution, and then natural selection is like the pistons of the chains that generate the force in natural populations. And when those variants are passed on to offspring, then that's like the gearbox of the differential in the engine, and it makes the whole population move.
Well, we're operating on a mathematical probability. In other words, remember that a mutation is simply a genetic accident. It is the instructions for making something going haywire, just simply by accident. And we have to assume that by accident, this jumbling of the instructions, instead of producing nonsense, actually produced a better instruction than the original instruction. And not only produced a better instruction, but it targeted a specific insecticide. It targeted DDT. Now, normally, that resistance exists somewhere within the genetic variation of a life form. And those individuals that possess that resistance survive an attack of DDT, and the rest of all of their the other members of their species are wiped out and then only those who have that inherent resistance survive and proliferate.
Well, you're right that mutations are a genetic accident, and you're also right that most of them are not going to be all of that useful. But what we have seen in this case is that insecticide, as we keep using that analogy, using insecticide has such a strong ecological impact that whenever one of these mutations happens, these accidents that are usually bad, but whenever one by accident happens that is beneficial because it duplicates one of these genes that helps the insect resist the organophosphate insecticide, that when that happens, then evolution occurs. And the odd thing is that we think, oh, that'll never happen because it's just so unlikely. But it does happen. And one of the important lessons that you can gain by looking around the world and seeing when evolution has happened is that you can see that it isn't that rare, that when we have huge populations of pests and we're really stressing them with huge doses of antibiotics or insecticides, then it's not that we rarely see these evolutionary changes happen. It's we always see these evolutionary changes happen. There's not a single insecticide in the world that insects have not evolved resistance to. There's not a single antibiotic that bacteria have not evolved resistance to. HIV is a chilling but wonderful example of evolution because inside every single person, the HIV virus accumulates the mutations necessary to overcome antiretroviral drugs. And we can see them happening one after another as this virus inexorably defeats the drugs we try to use against it. So it's important in this context to realize, yes, all those things might seem very unlikely, but we've seen them happen, and when you see the unlikely happen over and over and over, then you need to learn that lesson, that in fact you should begin to predict it and expect it and use what you know about the process to try to defeat it.
I have to jump in here because we're already at the midpoint and I have some other callers. It strikes me that here the disagreement that between you and the caller, it's not whether there is a recognizable phenomenon here, because it seems undeniable that we have bacteria that have become resistant to antibiotics and we have insects that have become resistant to pesticides. It doesn't seem like we're arguing over the effect. We're just arguing about what we're going to call it.
Well, that may be true, but one of the things about that is if you don't know what is causing something, you never know how to stop it. You never know how to affect the process so that you get to the point where it isn't bothering you as much. And I think that is the danger here, that if we don't understand that it's the evolutionary process at work, then there's nothing we can do to predict when it's going to be bad, when it's going to be okay. There's nothing we can do in advance to try to make it better. And what we can learn, though, if we understand it's evolution happening, is we can organize our hospitals so that it doesn't happen so quickly. We can change how our farming practices that it doesn't happen so quickly. People are doing that, but it's easier if you recognize the fundamental biological process happening.
Well, then that gets to another basic question, and that is as long as we intervene in the natural world to the extent that we do, this is going to happen, and that the only thing that we can hope to do is slow the process?
Well, I'm afraid that's true. When I started this book, I thought, well, I'll find some examples of when it really isn't happening. And I never did. We're not actually causing the evolution of elephants very much, I suppose, or whales, but that's because they're very long-lived creatures. But the kinds of organisms that spend their lives feeding on us or living with us are weeds and pests and diseases. They have very fast generation times, and very many of them are evolving because of our activities.
Our guest, Stephen Palumbi, professor of biology at Harvard University. His book is The Evolution Explosion, How Humans Cause Rapid Evolutionary Change. It's published by W.W. Norton. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. We have other callers we'll get right to. They're both in Urbana, so we'll take them in the order they came in, starting with line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Turn off my radio here. I was wondering if I could ask you something about genetics.
Sure, we could give it a shot.
Well, you mentioned that part of your title there at the beginning. They had someone on a month ago who was talking about the Human Genome Project in relation to breast cancer.
Yeah.
And she was adamant about ridiculing the Human Genome Project because half of the people who had been tested with the gene that they had said was a cause of breast cancer didn't have breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I would I tried to get her to admit on the air that it didn't have to be just one gene, but she wouldn't. So I was wondering if you might want to clarify that there are multiple genes for the same outcome sometimes, and that even with just two genes, like for blue eyes and brown eyes, you certainly get a lot of different colored eyes.
Well, it's certainly the case that genetics can be a pretty complicated thing, and I don't know very much about the genetics of breast cancer, so I can't comment directly about that. But I do know from looking at other examples that there are plenty of cases in which genes may appear in one person and have one effect, and the same copy of that gene could be in another person and not have that effect, depending upon the variation they had in other parts of the genome. So it's not the case that every gene is a switch that turns a light on and off all by itself.
And yeah, that's exactly.
There are switches that combine to turn lights on and off. And
yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, okay.
I think that she just kind of misled the audience a little bit, because she was just kind of being like a fundamentalist preacher there, hammering on something. And
it's probably
now we have another point of view to choose from. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. I guess the overall point to take away from that, again, is this idea that as we are starting to look at human genetic material and trying to figure out what exactly it does, what parts do what, and we are starting to point to certain things and say, well, maybe we think this here has something to do with breast cancer, and this over here has maybe something to do with heart disease, and this over here maybe has something to do with Alzheimer's disease, except we are a long, long way away from making some connection between that and being able to say, okay, later, this person's going to get breast cancer, this person's going to get heart disease, this person's going to get Alzheimer's. We just don't understand well enough how well it works and how those things interact with factors in the environment to which the person would be exposed. I think the bottom line, as I understand it, is that we're a long, long way. I mean, we know that genes play a role in disease, but we're a long way from understanding completely how exactly that works.
That's right. But the other lesson from all of that, because we know so much about our own genetics, is that we do have a lot of variation in our own population. Across the world, there's lots of genes with lots of different variants. And so even in us, there is genetic variation for important traits, and whether or not you get cancer or not. You know, the ability that you have for dealing with certain other kinds of environmental toxins, the variation in how drugs are metabolized is very important now in trying to fine-tune medical treatment. So we can take this as a great example of the kinds of variation there are in other species as well. It's not just us that has genetic variation. It's everything does. So that kind of lesson tells us that all over the world, all over the planet, in deep seas, all up into the tops of the highest mountain, there is this fuel for evolution to happen. And natural selection, when it's strong, can create lots of evolutionary change using the existing variation, like the first caller suggested, or allowing new mutations that arise in these populations to thrive when they wouldn't otherwise.
All right, let's go to another Urbana caller, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I've got two questions, I guess. I guess I'm trying to see if your guest has anything to comment about them. One would be a couple of years ago, a couple of professors from Purdue came up with the Trojan gene hypothesis. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Why don't you run through it so I might jog my memory.
Okay. Yeah, it had to do with they were working, they simulated what would happen if genetically modified fish were released into the environment. And the fish they were looking at were matured more quickly than the non-modified fish.
Right.
And they were also larger, and because of that, they were sexually selected by the other fish.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem was that only 2/3 of the normal number of fish would get to maturity in the first place. So what happened was the introduction of this genetically modified fish would in fact make that species extinct.
Right.
Yeah. And I was just curious if there were any more examples such as that that have been developed seems like a a really good example of where our trying to affect the evolution of other species could really cause a mess.
Yeah, that particular example is a very good one in that regard. There's been a huge amount of attention about what happens once we engineer new genes into domesticated plants and animals, and whether or not that's something that we ought to pay a lot of extra attention to. One way to look at it is that like you're suggesting, it really does add to the variation in the populations, and it really does qualify as a different sort of evolutionary change that we are injecting into live populations. And the Trojan gene problem, where the population is affected by this introduced gene in such a way that it can go extinct, is not something that we've seen, but that's because we've been so far pretty lucky about the escape of these genes into the rest of the world. Just as big a worry is the escape of genes from crop plants, say, into weeds that allow the weeds to become herbicide resistant. So a lot of farms out in the Midwest and elsewhere right now are using crops that have engineered into them a gene for glyphosate resistance. Glyphosate's a very strong herbicide. The crops can resist the herbicide, so that means you can do a lot of weed control without having to plow. The danger is that if we grow crops that have weeds around them that are closely related to the crops, that the gene will cross into the weeds, and the weeds will become very, very resistant. We haven't seen that happen yet, but it's early in the process. We have seen, though, that traits that are in crops selected by artificial selection have crossed into weeds. And I don't know the literature all that well, but I'm told, for example, you cannot grow rye in some parts of this country any longer because the weeds of rye are so good now, because they have got the selected genes from the rye crop, that the weeds choke off the crop and it's no longer economically profitable. So we have seen the escape of genes from selected crops into weeds. We haven't seen the escape of genetically modified genes yet wholesale into weeds, but many people are worried about that and are trying to hope and ensure that it doesn't happen.
Yeah, these two professors, Muir and Howard from Purdue,
right,
came to the conclusion that it would only take one fish to in such a situation to cause the species to get extinct. But my other question was, I was curious that whether or not you've looked into or know much about the possibility that our cultures really exist as stressors, and that that they are having a, you're talking about us affecting other species, but what about the effect of our selection of different cultures having an effect on our own genetic, on our own genome? Because I understand most of the time people will say that it takes too many generations.
Right.
And I'm beginning to think that that's short-sighted, and I'm wondering if you had much to say about that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. One of the other things that people say is that we're so good now at controlling our own environment that we've slowed our own evolution. That physically anymore we're stuck here, because we live in houses and we wear glasses and we have a nice food supply and so our physical evolution is really slowed down because we're buffering the environment from ourselves. But our cultural evolution is still rocketing along. And one of the things I try to say in the book, in a chapter about whether human evolution has stopped, is that human evolution actually really hasn't stopped. It's not that some of us aren't buffered from the environment, but that all of us aren't, and that the world is a very variable place, and that many, many people in the world are exposed to stresses and environmental problems that other people are really quite comfortable from and aren't affected by. One of the really amazing things about the juxtaposition of the evolution of diseases in this topic is that there's some diseases that are only curable if you're rich enough, because there are some diseases that have evolved to the point where the medicines to treat them are so expensive that we cannot afford them in many parts of the world. HIV is a great example. Again, unfortunately, we treat people in this country with triple drug therapy. It costs about $18,000 a year per person to treat for HIV. That cost is just out of the question in a lot of Central Africa and in Asia, where millions of people have HIV. They cannot afford the drugs to do it. Tuberculosis is another example. So in those settings where diseases are still playing a major role in mortality, the genetic variation we have for getting diseases or resisting them is really under strong evolutionary pressure. So I think in those cases, the evolution of humans is still ongoing. It's because we're not all that good at keeping these environmental pressures from impacting people.
We'll continue. We'll go to Belgium, line number 4, for another caller. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Most of the time in this discussion, you've been talking about diseases and evolution on a very, very genetic level.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that didn't Aboriginal peoples of the world have a very serious effect on the evolution of all kinds of animals, and it's going on even today. Considering the aspect of just where we're at here, the native peoples of America created a lot of fires for hunting, and therefore they changed the type of plants and makeup of the area.
Mm-hmm.
In a more recent history, in the 1700s, 1800s, exploration to islands introduced rats and mice into these islands and totally destroyed ecosystems there that lost great genetic aspects of things.
That's right, and there's two things you can look at there, and they're part and parcel of the same thing. You bring up a really good point that one of the impacts that people have on the environment is introducing other species into the environment or controlling the distribution of species, as you're putting it, through fire or, you know, just farm practices.
Yeah, farm practice, anything.
Anyway, so that's an ecological effect. My take on that would be to ask, what is the evolutionary effect of those ecological effects? So it's the secondary effect of what you were talking about.
Yes, exactly.
And we know there are some. For example, if you introduce a new insect into an area where its former host plant is not, it'll often evolve preference to a new host plant. Or introduce a new crop into an area, and the native insects will evolve a preference for that new crop. So we've seen that kind of thing go on all the time. It's the evolutionary aspect of that I'm personally interested in, not just the fact there happened to be rats on a particular island and didn't where they weren't before.
Well, no, the rats would kill the birds who were the top of the ecological species on that particular island.
That's right.
Changing the entire ecological framework of what was on that island before. They didn't have that kind of predator, and now they do.
That's right, and that's really critically important, and it's one of the main things that we tend to do in the world around us, but that doesn't necessarily lead to evolution. There are examples of it, and so what I was trying to do, at least in the book, is to focus on examples of where that kind of ecological change results in evolutionary change. There is one example that I can easily point to, and that's the introduction of fish into different lakes and streams around the world.
Mm.
And there's small species of fish that are native in these streams, small wild guppies in Trinidad and in Central America, for example. And where there are no predatory fish, the males are really brightly colored red and green and gold, and they have long fins, and they're just all happy males, and they succeed by attracting females who prefer to mate with the really brightly colored males. But you introduce predatory fish into these streams, and the predatory fish are attracted to the brightly colored males as well, and they eat them up just as fast as anything. So what you get is the evolution of really dull-colored fish in these streams, because these introduced predatory fish have gone through and wiped out all the really brightly colored ones. So that's an example of the ecological change then having an evolutionary effect on these environments.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I guess what we're going back to is the point I think you're trying to make is, as the caller suggests, it is true that human beings have, as far as we know, for a long, long time, have altered the environment to the extent that their technology gave them the ability to do that.
That's right.
That now is different is that our technology has given us the ability to alter the environment to an extent never before possible, and in ways that are perhaps more dramatic, have more problematic consequences, and stories that play out much faster than they did before. And it seems the cautionary angle of the story that you tell is that we ought to think carefully about what we do before we do it, because the consequences can be so significant.
Well, that's exactly right. And what we've seen, you know, is that we'll invent something and it'll be very useful, and then industrialize it to an enormous degree. DDT is a very good example. It was first used in Naples by the Allied armies in 1943 and 44, and within a few years, millions of pounds a month were being produced by the industrialized countries of the world and spread all over the world to combat insects. And that huge industrialization potential meant that all over the world, insects began to evolve resistance to DDT. We see it over and over and over again that evolution is a consequence of this kind of chemical approach to insects, weeds, diseases, etc. And what we do is we invent them and we deploy them, and then are surprised a few years later when something evolves resistance to them and scurry around trying to find something different. Instead, it makes sense to say, okay, we're going to do this because, in fact, DDT saved millions of lives. But we're going to expect evolution to happen. We're going to build it into our plan for how we're going to use this chemical. And it'll turn out that if we do that from the beginning, we can slow down evolution. Hospitals right now are trying to slow down the evolution of antibiotic resistance by strategizing, by not using the same antibiotic forever in the same place. They're cycling antibiotics, using some one time, others another time. And that kind of approach can really allow us to have a better handle on things like diseases we can't cure and insects we can't control, etc. That makes it cheaper for us. We don't pay this evolutionary cost. And it's because we've taken a look at it and said, okay, I'm not afraid of calling it evolution. Evolution happens. I'm just going to use my knowledge of it to actually affect this better change.
We just have a couple of minutes. We have two callers. I don't think I'll be able to do them both, but we'll at least try to get one in Urbana, line one. Hello?
Line one?
Yes.
Oh, well, maybe you've mostly answered my question. I wanted to ask about an argument against some of the approaches to genetically modified foods, like the ones like BT corn and Roundup Ready, herbicide-resistant plants.
Right.
It seems like we could make a stronger argument against them if you could make an estimate of, you know, to say that in 10 or 15 years these will be mostly ineffective, except that they will have done, you know, ancillary damage by killing off other things in the environment. Is anyone who's opposing these making such an argument? I hear a lot of people arguing about them, you know, worrying that they'll be directly dangerous to humans, but I'd be a lot more worried about the environmental effects.
Well, it is a worry, actually. BT corn is a good example, or BT cotton, any of them, because insects can evolve resistance to those toxins. BT corn has a gene in it that makes a BT toxin. The BT toxin kills certain kinds of insects.
Yeah.
And those insects, at least some of them, are known to be able to evolve resistance to the toxic effects of that one protein. So the danger is, the worry is, that by deploying BT crops so widely, we're doing exactly the same thing we did with DDT, of creating evolutionary pressures to cause the insects to evolve resistance to these toxins. Now, there have been a number of theoretical and sort of arguments about how to slow that down, and in fact, many farmers now, when they buy BT seeds, are required to plant a refuge. That is, a fraction of their field that does not have BT seeds. The crops grow up without the BT toxin. They're not allowed to spray. Insects take over that part of the field and grow up without the resistance genes for BT toxins. They swamp out the insects in the other part of the field, and by doing that, they slow the evolution of BT.
Who does the requiring? I'd never heard of this.
Well, you look it up. The companies that are selling BT seeds are...
Oh, I see. Thanks.
Doing it under those circumstances. The EPA has suggested a 4 to 8% refuge size, and if you look into it, you'll see that it's really one of the major ways that the evolution of BT resistance is trying to be slowed, because that is the problem. It's a big expense to engineer these genes into crops, and you don't want them to evolve to be useless in just a few years, because one, it doesn't pay off your investment, and two, you're evolving the insects to actually resist BT toxin, which right now is a very good organic insecticide.
We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, because we've used our time. For people who are interested in reading, however, more on the subject, you can look for the book we've mentioned. It's titled The Evolution Explosion, published by Norton and by our guest, Stephen Palumbi. He's professor of biology at Harvard University. Professor Palumbi, thanks very much for talking with us.
David, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.